Look, I grew up on the streets of Brooklyn in Borough Park. And I have to tell you that there was more wisdom on those streets than among the faculty of the Harvard Law School. The common sense, the attitudes, the smarts. We give much too much credit to public intellectuals, to professors, to academics. They don't have all the answers. On many issues, they are just dead wrong. The jury is uniquely American. We're the only country in the world that elects judges and elects prosecutors, and it's a scandal. We shouldn't. Judges hold themselves as gods, and juries are a system of checks and balances on the judges. And when you have 12 or 6 independent people coming off the street and going back to the street, it really serves as a very, very important check and balance on the elitism, otherwise, of our justice system, coupled with the populism. Judges are terrified to render judgments that are unpopular. It's not perfect. It's not flawless. It's riddled with problems, but it's better than the alternative.
Welcome to episode 9 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wolin. That was the one and only Professor Alan Dershowitz, and he'll be joining us a little later in the show to discuss a very important topic. But before we get to that subject, I've got a confession to make. Of the 47 books published by Thomas Sowell to date, there is one book of his which I still consider to be my all-time favorite Sowell book. It's not one which I often hear mentioned by other Sowell fans. Even Jason Riley, in his Sowell biography called Maverick, only pulls one quote from this book, and he mentions the book only one other time, in passing. Yet when friends and other newbies ask me which Sowell book I recommend they read first, I always name this particular title. This book was published in 2010 and is called Intellectuals and Society. In preparation for this episode, I sat down to reread Intellectuals and Society for a third time. As I always do when I read books, I highlighted the passages I really like so I can find the good parts later. The problem with this book is there are so many great passages that I find myself pretty much highlighting the entire book. It would be a lot easier if I used a thick black marker and just crossed out the passages I don't like, which are few and far between. So why do I like this book so much? I can think of no other Sowell book, and no other book by any other author for that matter, which more dramatically reframes the way I see the world than Intellectuals and Society. In this book, Sowell makes the case that intellectuals, the supposedly smartest people in society, often get it wrong. And not just a little bit wrong, or sort of wrong. Sowell makes the case that intellectuals often get it completely and massively wrong. Sowell gives literally dozens of examples of renowned public intellectuals getting it wrong on the most important issues of society, from the causes of crime, to how to prevent war, to how to bring about economic growth, to the proper role of judges in society. Intellectuals have steered their countries from one disaster to another, and yet they never seem to pay a price for so grossly misleading the public. Sowell explains why public intellectuals so often get it wrong. It's not because they are dumb or ill-informed. If only it were that simple. No, they get it wrong because of the career, financial, and reputational incentives which go along with being a professional intellectual. Intellectuals and Society is Sowell's greatest book because once you realize that the so-called smartest people in the world often, and perhaps even usually, get it all wrong, you can never again go back to passively accepting the pronouncements of the intelligentsia. Never again go back to outsourcing your thinking to them. Once you have seen what Sowell shows you in this book, you can't unsee it. Your brain is permanently rewired. Remember the movie The Matrix? There's a famous scene in that movie where Morpheus, played by Lawrence Fishburne, offers Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, the one-time chance to see the truth about the world. He offers him a choice of two pills, a red pill and a blue pill. If he takes the red pill, he will see the reality of the world and his situation. If he takes the blue pill, he will remain in a happy state of anesthetized and blissful ignorance about how the world really works. Here's that scene.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. Follow me.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. Morpheus never promised Neo he would like what he was going to see. I think this movie is a great metaphor for Sowell's lifetime body of work. Sowell shows you the truth. He presents the facts. He lays out the evidence. He never promises you're going to like it. Life isn't fair. It never has been. It never will be.
You take the red pill.
Some groups are better at certain things than other groups.
You take the red pill.
Human nature is flawed. Human beings are flawed. There is no utopia, and there are no ultimate solutions to life's problems.
You take the red pill.
As Sowell often said,
people say, you know, you're a very tough person. I'm not tough. Life is tough. I'm merely trying to acquaint you with those facts.
I suspect I'm not the only one who has had the experience of being red-pilled after being exposed to Sowell's books. Since I started this podcast, I get tons of emails from people who can't contain their enthusiasm for Sowell's ideas. Sumita in California wrote me and she said,
I have spent the last 18 months immersing myself in Thomas Sowell's books, and as you mentioned in your commentary, I too cannot refrain from quoting or referring to Sowell as I speak about anything, anywhere.
Larry in Pennsylvania wrote, thanks for the podcast you do on Sowell. He has had more influence on how I think than any human outside my parents. He's simply the most amazing person I've found. Vernell from South Carolina wrote,
I'm a grandmother and it thrills me that my 16-year-old granddaughter tells others about Thomas Sowell. When I asked her how she heard about him, she said, from you, Mom. That warmed my heart to know that she remembered. Keep on shining his light. You never know who may see it.
Trent from Oregon wrote, Sowell provides a more honest way of perceiving our world. And honesty is a virtue that I trust. And it's really as simple as that. I'm open to a better method, but I haven't found one yet. By the way, those emails from female listeners were read by my wife, the wonderful Priyanka Wolin. She has only read one Sowell book, Black Rednecks and White Liberals. And while she did find it interesting and challenging, I can't honestly say that she has yet to swallow the Sowellian red pill. But don't worry, I'm still working on her. Speaking of my wife, I'd like to share with you one of Sowell's all-time greatest quotes, which I think about on a daily basis. Quote, "One of the most foolish and most dangerous things one can do is to take love for granted, instead of nurturing it and safeguarding it as the prize jewel of one's life." End quote. Now is the time you might want to rewind this podcast 15 seconds to listen to that quote again, to really let it sink in. If you can internalize Sowell's message here, I promise you, it will be life-changing. And if you like that quote, you should know that it is one of the 50 Sowell quotes I printed in the pad of post-it notes I'm sending to listeners of this podcast at no charge. Free. No catch, no gimmicks. Each pad contains 50 different Sowell quotes, which you can literally stick anywhere, on your bathroom mirror, on the refrigerator, or out in public if you want to introduce strangers to the wit and wisdom of you-know-who. I will put a link in the show notes to the 50 Sowell quotes so you can see what the post-it notes look like and which quotes I picked. Feel free to print out these quotes as much as you like and hang them up or do with them as you please. Okay, back to the book. While rereading Intellectuals and Society, I collected a couple hundred great quotes and passages, any one of which is profound enough to build an entire podcast episode around. That's how good this book is. But what I'd like to do now is attempt to summarize this book into a manageable number of key concepts, which I hope will help us to wrap our brains around this monumental work. Here goes. Sowell lays out 10 key arguments in the book. Number 1. Intellectuals influence and shape public opinion, even when most people don't read or even hear their ideas firsthand. Number 2. Intellect is not wisdom. A person can be very smart. They can possess the ability to articulate complex ideas and concepts, and yet still not possess worldly wisdom. Here's a telling passage from the audiobook version of Intellectuals and Society.
Wisdom requires self-discipline and an understanding of the realities of the world, including the limitations of one's own experience and of reason itself. The opposite of intellect is dullness or slowness, but the opposite of wisdom is foolishness, which is far more dangerous.
What I find truly fascinating about this passage is the suggestion that reason itself has limitations. What? You mean they can't figure everything out? Solve every problem? Answer every question? It seems to me this is an area where most intellectuals lack true wisdom, in thinking they can figure everything out if only they just think about it hard enough. Number 3. Intellectuals are fools. This concept is a recurring theme in Intellectuals and Society, and if you get nothing else but this from reading the book, it would be enough to serve you well for years to come. Sowell quotes Orwell when he says,
"George Orwell said that some ideas are so foolish that only an intellectual could believe them, for no ordinary man could be such a fool."
The notion that the smartest people are the only ones who can believe the dumbest things is the true red pill concept of this book. Once you have seen this principle in action, you can't unsee it, and you can never forget it. In the book, Sowell gives example after example after example of the smartest and most renowned intellectuals of their day throwing the full weight of their reputations and authority into the most foolish and disastrous ideas mankind has ever invented. In particular, Sowell goes into a lengthy discussion about the thinking of intellectuals in Europe between World War I and World War II, and how they were so convinced that appeasing Germany was the key to peace in Europe, without realizing that their pacifism itself was paradoxically the very cause of World War II, because it emboldened Hitler into thinking a war against those unwilling to fight was easily winnable. And he was almost right. Number 4. Intellectuals win, not when their ideas work in the real world, but when other intellectuals approve of their ideas. The ideas of an engineer or a scientist or a football coach are validated by testing those ideas empirically in the real world. Does the building stand? Does the invention work? Does the football team win games? That's how their ideas get validated. But an intellectual's ideas get validated in a totally different process, by whether or not other intellectuals approve of them. And even when their original ideas turn out to have been completely false, as long as other intellectuals continue to revere them, they suffer no loss of esteem or reputation. Sowell gives the example of environmentalist Paul Ehrlich.
Environmentalist Paul Ehrlich said in 1968, "The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, the world will undergo famines. Hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now." Yet after that decade and later decades had come and gone, not only had nothing of the sort happened, a growing problem in a growing number of countries was obesity and unsalable agricultural surpluses. But Professor Ehrlich continued to receive not only popular acclaim, but also honors and grants from prestigious academic institutions.
Number 5. Intellectuals have a vastly inflated sense of their own general wisdom. It is not uncommon to find an intellectual with specialized skills in one very narrow and specific domain to hold forth with authority and moral certitude on a wide range of topics outside their specialty. Noam Chomsky is an example of this phenomenon, which Sowell names in his book. A noted linguist in his day, most people had never heard of Chomsky until he stepped outside his specialty and became a self-proclaimed expert in politics and world affairs. Sowell quotes George Stigler on this subject when he says, quote, "Stigler said of some of his fellow Nobel laureates, they issue stern ultimata to the public on almost a monthly basis, and sometimes on no other basis."
The fatal misstep of many among the intelligentsia is in generalizing from their mastery of a certain kind of knowledge to a general wisdom in the affairs of the world, which is to say, in the affairs of other people, whose knowledge of their own affairs is far greater than what any given intellectual can hope to have. It has been said that a fool can put on his coat better than a wise man can put it on for him.
Number 6. Intellectuals employ their superior communication skills to convince others and to evade the testing of their favorite notions. Sowell calls this skill verbal virtuosity, and he uses the phrase 44 times throughout the book in a wide range of contexts. Yes, I counted. Here's an example of him using the concept.
Some intellectuals who have been opposed to the principle of racism have nevertheless remained either silent or apologetic when black community leaders have made racist attacks on Asian storekeepers in black ghettos, or on whites in general, or Jews in particular. Some intellectuals have even redefined racism in a way to make blacks ineligible for the label. Another exercise in verbal virtuosity.
Number 7. There are two basic visions of the world and human nature, which are in competition with each other. What Sowell calls the tragic vision versus the vision of the anointed. 23 years before publishing Intellectuals and Society, Sowell wrote an entire book on this subject called A Conflict of Visions. It is a truly paradigm-shifting book, and I highly recommend it. As an aside, I will be leading a live online book club about A Conflict of Visions on January 5th, 2022. If you'd like to participate in this live book discussion, please email me and I'll see if I can find you a spot. Sowell discusses the competition between these two visions again in Intellectuals and Society. This is a running theme in almost all his books, actually. Here's one passage I like a lot.
The two visions differ fundamentally, not only in how they see the world, but also in how those who believe in these visions see themselves. If you happen to believe in free markets, judicial restraint, traditional values, and other features of the tragic vision, then you are just someone who believes in free markets, judicial restraint, and traditional values. There is no personal exaltation resulting from those beliefs. But to be for social justice and saving the environment, or to be anti-war, is more than just a set of beliefs about empirical facts. This vision puts you on a higher moral plane, as someone concerned and compassionate, someone who is for peace in the world, a defender of the downtrodden, and someone who wants to preserve the beauty of nature and save the planet from being polluted by others less caring. In short, one vision makes you somebody special, and the other vision does not. These visions are not symmetrical.
Number 8. Intellectuals and Common Sense. Sowell makes the argument that intellectuals often lack basic common sense in the affairs of the world.
Many people over the years have accused intellectuals of not having common sense, but it may be expecting too much to expect most intellectuals to have common sense when their whole role in life is based on their being uncommon, that is, saying things that are different from what everyone else is saying. Yet there is only so much genuine originality in anyone. Beyond some point, being uncommon can mean indulging in pointless eccentricities or clever attempts to mock or shock. Politically, it can mean seeking dramatic ideological solutions instead of prudent trade-offs.
Number 9. Intellectuals are often attracted to violence. This argument of Sowell's is very counterintuitive and paradoxical. One would think that intellectuals would be against all forms of violence and would favor argument over physical aggression. Not so, says Sowell.
The association of intellectuals with violence occurs too often to be dismissed as an aberration. Often it takes the form of admiring those men of action who practice violence. Mussolini had an astonishing number of intellectual followers, by no means all of them Italian. In his ascent to power, Hitler consistently was most successful on the campus, his electoral appeal to students regularly outstripping his performance among the population as a whole. He always performed well among teachers and university professors. Many intellectuals were drawn into the higher echelons of the Nazi Party and participated in the more gruesome excesses of the SS. Thus, the four Einsatzgruppen, or mobile killing battalions, which were the spearhead of Hitler's final solution in Eastern Europe, contained an unusually high proportion of university graduates among the officers.
Number 10. Intellectuals overvalue the type of knowledge they are good at and undervalue more mundane and widely distributed types of knowledge, even though the latter types of knowledge may be of more consequential importance in the real world. This is the distinction between being book smart and being street smart. Sowell writes,
in short, much of the special kind of knowledge concentrated among intellectuals may not have as weighty consequences as much mundane or intellectually unimpressive knowledge scattered among the population at large. In the aggregate, mundane knowledge can vastly outweigh the special knowledge of elites, both in its amount and in its consequences.
Another great Sowell quote, which I didn't appreciate when I first read it, but I've grown to appreciate more and more over time, is this one. Quote, a diamond may be worth much more than a penny, but enough pennies will be worth more than any diamond. End quote. That's another Sowellicism, which is worth rewinding this podcast to listen to again so that it can sink in. Intellectuals think that because their intelligence or knowledge is greater than the average person's, this means that most of the wisdom in society is concentrated within their ranks, while in fact, vastly more knowledge and wisdom is widely distributed among the public at large than is concentrated within the intelligentsia. Sowell wrote an entire book on this subject called Knowledge and Decisions, which is my second favorite Sowell book. In that book, he argues that most knowledge is widely distributed throughout society among millions of pennies, and only a small portion of society's knowledge resides with the diamonds. When I reflect on this subject, my mind goes to one of America's proudest institutions, the jury system. We Americans are so used to important trials being decided by juries of everyday people that it's hard for us to imagine any viable alternative. In most other countries, however, both civil and criminal cases get decided by a single judge or a small panel of judges, i.e., by intellectual elites. I rarely, if ever, hear anyone say that our jury system should be abolished, the way I sometimes hear people argue that our electoral college system should be abolished. Even when a jury trial gets decided in a way some people abhor, I never hear those people say, "Yet another reason to abolish the jury system." Instead, they point to the fact that the jury was stacked with too many of this type of person and too little of some other type of person for it to be fair, but never that the jury system itself is at fault. Nor have I ever heard the argument made that potential jurors should have to demonstrate some minimum level of intellect, like a minimum IQ or SAT score or academic degree. Even the U.S. Army has a minimum intelligence required in order to serve, but not juries. We Americans must have, in our national DNA perhaps, a belief in the general wisdom of the common man. Here's an interesting thought experiment. If you were on trial for a crime, would you rather your fate be determined by a panel of highly educated judges or by a jury of common people? Interesting question, don't you think? Where does true wisdom in our society really reside? Widely distributed among common people or highly concentrated within an intellectual elite? To help me explore this question for myself, I took a field trip to a local cafe, unironically named Intelligentsia Coffee, located in the heart of Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard. Intelligentsia is frequented by LA's hipster class, wannabe actors, producers, directors, screenwriters, and other Hollywood types, which Sowell might say operate in the, quote, penumbra of the intellectual class. I asked random people there if they support our jury system, and if they themselves were on trial, if they would prefer to be judged by highly educated judges or by a jury of common people. Here are some clips from those conversations.
This year we've had very prominent jury cases like Jussie Smollett and Kyle Rittenhouse, and Elizabeth Holmes is on trial right now, and we had Derek Chauvin, and a lot of big jury trials.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if you are a fan of the jury system, if you think it's a good system, and why?
I mean, I don't know that I'm an authority to be speaking on the jury system, but in general, I think that it leaves too much room for bias. So that's really my main issue with it. It's super easy to strike down minorities, like from juries. There's a lot of like discretion that the prosecutors have that I don't think contributes to a fair system. So in general, I'm not a huge fan of it.
So do you think a judge-based system where it's just judges would be any better?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think that these are biases that people, individual people have that you'd see with judges and juries. So I don't really know what a more equitable way of going about things would, I guess trying to maybe remove as much opportunity for bias as possible. So I guess maybe making it harder to strike down jurors, that sort of thing would probably help. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this question. If you were on trial for a serious crime, Would you rather your fate be decided by a jury of common people or a panel of highly educated judges?
If the common man is actually invested in the outcome and making sure that it's actually fair, then sure. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say because I feel like it's flawed overall.
So how would you want these sort of trials to be decided? If you're not a fan of judges and you're not a fan of juries, how would you want it to work?
I mean, I don't know. Juries still seem, I guess, a bit more balanced in terms of, like, I guess a bit more fair in terms of checks and balances on the judicial system. But, yeah, I guess I'd go with juries. But, you know, if, I guess, with more oversight maybe on, you know, on the overall system.
I think it's not perfect, but I think it's a pretty decent system overall. I think the theory and philosophy behind it came from a well-intentioned place. And yeah, I think it's probably better than most other systems out there. And I think, at least in theory, it should be a pretty fair system. Being judged by a jury of your peers. So
now, juries are made up of just regular, everyday people. They don't have to pass any kind of intelligence test. I mean, there could be people on a jury who think the earth is flat. You don't know about their background or intelligence that much. Do you think it might be better if there was some sort of minimum intelligence requirement, maybe an IQ test or an SAT score, or maybe a high school diploma, or at least something that you know that your jury is at least of a minimum competency, mentally?
No. I think that the whole point is that it's supposed to be representative of your community or the society, so there needs to be a mixture of different people. And I think if you did that, then, first of all, it wouldn't be representative of the community or society. And also, I think that assuming that just because someone has a lower IQ or just because they don't have a certain degree, that doesn't mean that they're not able to make the decision that a juror would be able to make. So I don't think that's like a fair statement or correct assumption.
Now, if you were on trial for a serious crime, would you prefer to be judged by a jury of common people than, let's say, a panel of highly educated judges?
That's a tough one, but no, I still think just a jury of common people. And there's no reason why I should get any different treatment than anyone else. And if that's the system that I'm saying I'm advocating for, then yeah, it would be wrong of me to say that I wanted a different one. So.
Now, the last question, America is pretty much the only country that really has a functioning jury system, believe it or not. What do you think about that?
I didn't know that. I think that's kind of surprising. And I think it's also, maybe it's ironic because I think our system gets a lot of hate, maybe more so from Americans than other people in the world. But I guess the irony is that I think it's actually not that bad of a system. I think the application doesn't go the way we want, or at least maybe some people in this country would want it to go. And I think it absolutely has a lot of flaws. But again, I think the foundational basis actually is pretty good. We might just need to alter the application and make some tweaks to it. But yeah, I was not aware that we're one of the few countries that...
I mean, the jury system makes sense, you know? You get to see how the public views the case. I mean, back in the olden times, they had, like, British jury represent American colonists, and you could see how the problems, like, were present there because the British people weren't accurately representing the American colonists because they weren't, living in North America at the time, and they didn't have the same views. So I guess the jury is important in the sense, to have sort of a perspective of other people and similar setting.
So do you believe in the common sense and wisdom of the average person?
Yeah, because I'm an average person, so I believe in myself, I guess.
I think it's you know, part of our democracy, and it's part of what allegedly creates equality in terms of when people are on trial, they get to be judged by a jury of their peers. But the question is, like, are they actually a jury of their peers, or is it all white people, or is it all people who would have opinions that are biased about the certain issues that are on trial? Even if they try to weed out the people who are biased by jury selection, I think it's, in theory, it's a good idea, and in practice, it often gets corrupted.
Now, if you were on trial for a serious crime, would you prefer that your fate be decided by a jury of common, everyday people, or would you prefer a panel of educated judges?
I think a jury would be what I would prefer to be. I mean, I can see why having an educated panel of experts would be useful, but I'm coming from like a more moral place. Like, I think that's the way that things are done in this country, and so I would prefer the justice system to be carried out in the way that it is currently organized.
You know, I can see where, you know, on the one hand, the lack of expertise and sort of the seeming like randomness of a jury of your peers can feel unreliable, but it also safeguards against a type of corruption that could potentially take root if we don't do that. So I think if I had to say whether, considering those two things, whether I support the jury, I still think that it is a good thing. I don't have a better solution, really.
The way the world is polarized right now, to when you're part of like this like huge like neoliberal education system, like, and you go to an Ivy League and like maybe you're the smartest in your field, I think there's just like such a wide spectrum of lived experience that is like intellectualized away. So I think I'll, even though it's a lot riskier, I'll go with the common man or woman.
Now that we've heard from the patrons of the Intelligentsia Cafe in Los Angeles, let's hear from a true legal expert on the subject of juries to help us wrap our brains around this important institution. Alan Dershowitz was a professor of law at Harvard Law School for 5 decades. He has written close to 50 books on a wide range of topics, from history to law to Israel to terrorism, impeachment, cancel culture, censorship, and many, many other subjects. He is an intellectual polymath in the true sense of the term. His latest book is called The Case for Vaccine Mandates, and we'll be talking about that book after we discuss his thoughts on our jury system. Professor Dershowitz is not just a legal academic. During his long tenure at Harvard Law School, he never stopped practicing law in the courtroom, and has represented a wide range of clients, including celebrities in trouble, as well as many worthy causes where he worked pro bono with no legal fees. Some of his celebrity clients include O.J. Simpson, Klaus von Bülow, Mike Tyson, Julian Assange, Donald Trump, and many others. Professor Dershowitz, welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Well, thank you, Thomas Sowell truly is a genius, and so I'm privileged to be on a show with that name.
Excellent. So why don't you start by telling us how you know Thomas Sowell, what you've read of him, and what you think about his work?
Well, I've always followed his work very carefully. I don't agree with it all. He's more conservative than I am on a lot of issues, but he's very thoughtful, and he speaks for himself. And it's very important that so many different voices are associated with being an African-American, with being a conservative African-American, a thoughtful African-American, and a thoughtful American in general. So I'm a big fan.
And have you read any of his books, or have you just followed his columns?
Read his books, his writings, his op-eds, television. You know, generally I'm familiar with his mostly. Yeah.
So the book that we're talking about on this episode exclusively is Intellectuals and Society, which I think that was written in 2010. And I think that is his, you know, his best work for several reasons. And one of the main theses of this work is that intellectuals often get it completely wrong. And he talks about the incentives and constraints that go along with being a professional public intellectual and why that leads them to make so many mistakes.
Well, he's not the person who have said that. I mean, Thomas Jefferson said, put an issue to a plowman or a philosopher, and you're more likely to get a better answer from a philosopher, from the plowman than the philosopher. Look, I grew up on the streets of Brooklyn in Borough Park. And I have to tell you that there was more wisdom on those streets than among the faculty at the Harvard Law School or the Yale Law School where I attended. The common sense, the attitudes, the smarts. We live in a very elitist society, less elitist than much of Europe. But we give much too much credit to public intellectuals, to professors, to academics. They don't have all the answers. On many issues, they are just dead wrong. And they're also extremely, extremely biased and one-sided. And the academy today is not playing the appropriate role as part of our system of checks and balances on excesses of the other branches. They're failing their job miserably. Also, academia is a club, and it's a popularity club. I'll give you an example, a self-serving example. There's the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is located at Harvard University. And in general, the criteria for becoming a member is not only having a distinguished academic career, but also having a public intellectual career. But I was blackballed from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences because of my support for Israel. And I heard it from many, many, many sources that I was regarded as too strident, too opinionated on Israel. And so I was not allowed into the club. Can you imagine anybody more qualified? I've written now 49 books. I've been a prominent public intellectual. I've been involved in every major issue of the day. My academic writings have been praised, and my public writings have been praised. And all these obscure people in the American Academy, some of whom have written nothing and done nothing, voted essentially to blackball me because they didn't like my views on Israel. And so that's been very common in the academy. And I've heard that story from other people. I've heard that story from people of every background, not only with the American Academy, but other academic institutions and appointments. Today, to be appointed to academia, you have to be politically correct. I just saw recently that, I think it was at the University of California, San Francisco, somewhere on the West Coast, part of the University of California system, they had criteria for hiring a theoretical physicist. And among the criteria for hiring a theoretical physicist, Albert Einstein, was his support for diversity. Well, what if you had an academic superstar? And there have been many who have won Nobel Prizes and don't agree with political correctness today. They're not put on the faculty. There was a professor at Stanford who won the Nobel Prize for inventing the transistor. And he didn't believe in racial diversity. In fact, he had some very negative views about a race that would probably disqualify him from being president of the NAACP or ACLU or other organizations. But it should disqualify him from being a member of the physics or science faculty or a law faculty. So I think the criteria for becoming a public intellectual or a member of faculties today are so skewed politically that I think that Sewell's correct.
Now, even though Sewell doesn't talk about the jury system in intellectuals and society, I kept thinking about it, how America seems to be really fascinated with the jury system. And I wanted you to tell us a little bit about, is America the only country that really has such a strong jury system? You know, where do we rank with that internationally? And what's the theory behind it, going back to our founding?
Well, we rank first, without a doubt. We copied it from England, but England doesn't have a jury system anymore. It has 12 chairs that are moved around by the judge. The judge tells the jury what to decide. The jury has much, much less power in England. Most other countries in the world have abolished juries or have never had it in the first place. The jury is uniquely American. And remember Jacksonian democracy, which starts, you know, in the third decade of the 18th, 19th century really changed the nature of America. America was a republic before Jackson. It turned into a democracy under Jackson, for better or worse. Jackson did some terrible, terrible things, particularly to Native Americans and others. And, you know, he was a bigot in many ways, as many populists were over time. But he introduced a lot of what we now have as populism in the judicial system, elected judges, elected prosecutors. We're the only country in the world that elects judges and elects prosecutors. And it's a scandal. We shouldn't, but we do. And not that appointed judges are always any better. You know, there's the old joke about the angel Gabriel coming to Sigmund Freud and saying, God needs a psychiatrist. He's having delusions of grandeur. He thinks he's a judge. And, you know, judges hold themselves as gods. And juries are a system of checks and balances on the judges. Judges certainly sometimes favor a particular outcome, but the jury won't let them have it. And when you have 12 or six independent people coming off the street and going back to the street, it really serves as a very, very important check and balance on the elitism, otherwise, of our justice system, coupled with the populism. I mean, our system of justice combines some of the worst elements of populism and elitism together. And a jury is an important part of that. It gets it wrong sometimes, but it gets it wrong in ways that are importantly a check on the rightness of judges.
Now, there have been a lot of famous cases in this past year, like Jesse Smollett, Derek Chauvin, Elizabeth Holmes going on right now, Kyle Rittenhouse. How do you think those cases might have come out differently if we had a bench trial for them?
I think they might have come out very differently. Judges are terrified to render judgments that are unpopular. They don't want to have to go home to their neighborhood and become pariahs, so they're willing to allow it to go to the jury. Let's remember one thing. Over 90% of jury trials in criminal cases go to the government. The government wins almost every jury trial. And it's remarkable that they've lost so many recently. And that's probably a symptom of the fact that prosecutors are being too political. I mean, for example, the Potter case, Officer Potter, who accidentally shot a young black man using her gun instead of her taser, it never would have been brought as a criminal case. But for the racial issues surrounding us, that wasn't a case brought by justice. It was a case brought by mob rule. And as we sit here today, we don't know what the outcome is. It's before the jury, as are several other cases right now. But that case never should have been brought in the first place. And I sure hope the jury does the right thing and tells the prosecution that it was a terrible mistake to charge a 27-year veteran police officer who made a tragic mistake with a crime that could let her end up in jail for 10 years.
Now, what about a common theme that I see when I talk to friends and family is there's a tremendous reluctance to serve on a jury. Everybody wants to know how they can get out of it.
Yeah.
And what's your experience with that? I mean, are we left with the only people that serve on juries or the unemployed, essentially?
No, I mean, I think everybody should serve on the jury. I try to serve on a jury. I actually was called to serve on a jury, and I got past the first round of disqualifications, and I sat in the jury box, and the judge called the prosecutor over and said, "You don't want that guy on the jury. He'll write a book about the case." And so they got rid of me. My wife has had the same experience. She's been thrown off juries because of who she's married to. My father had the same experience when he was alive. And so I think there are a lot of people who would like to serve on juries and a lot of people who don't. But it's part of citizenship. If you vote and you should vote, you should serve on juries.
Right. What do you think about, I know there's a lot of money spent on psychologists and experts to help pick jurors. Does that undermine the efficacy of the jury system as a check and balance on the elitism of judges and politicians?
Well, excuse the system, because the wealthy can afford it. Most lawyers, most litigants can't afford to hire experts. Those that do get an advantage. There's no question. In the O.J. Simpson case, we had a brilliant jury analyst who gave us some very important insights into patterns of voting by women, black women, et cetera, et cetera. It helped us a lot. If my clients can afford it or I can afford it, I will often use a jury expert. But it does. I mean, look, everything that costs money skews the system because it favors the wealthy. The same is true of the medical system or the housing or the educational system. We live in a society where it's better to be rich than poor.
So true. Yes, my mother used to always say, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor as long as you have money.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the grand jury system. Most people I know don't really understand it.
They shouldn't. It's a fraud. It's a scandal. It should be abolished immediately. The framers of the Constitution intended a grand jury to be a barrier to prosecution. Today, it is the prosecutor's handmaiden. The prosecution can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich, as Judge Walker once put it. Grand juries do anything the prosecutor wants them to do. The grand jury has become, instead of a shield to protect defendants, it's become a sword for the prosecution to use. It should be abolished. It should never be used. It's a scandal. It's inconsistent with the Constitution. And if it is going to be used, the court should exercise control over it, which they don't do.
So when is it actually used now? Is it used on every major case?
Has to be under the federal system. Federal system requires grand jury indictment, but it's a formality. You can waive a grand jury indictment. You can go by information, et cetera. But the grand jury is part of our constitutional system, not in every state, but in the United States government. And therefore, it's used by the prosecution, misused by the prosecution.
Now, is there ever a time when you are defending someone and you request a bench trial instead of a jury trial? Is that ever in your advantage?
Yes, rarely, but sometimes. In the racial atmosphere that we're now going through, it may be an advantage sometimes to get a bench trial, but it really depends. It depends on whether the judge is elected or appointed. In the federal system, they're appointed. In the state system, they're elected in about half the states or so. And so it really depends. Every case is going to be different. But yes, sometimes you want to. In fact, you know, it's interesting that a defendant has no right under the federal system to a bench trial. The government has to agree, even though trial by jury in the Constitution is a right of a defendant, the courts have absurdly ruled. Chief Justice Earl Warren ruled it, the prosecution can prevent the defendant from waiving his right to trial by jury and having a trial by bench. That's a wrong decision. It should be overruled.
So you're saying the defendant should be able to insist on a bench trial if he wants?
The jury trial is his right, not the government's.
I see. Okay. Tell us something about a directed verdict. Is that where a judge overrules a jury's decision?
Well, no, there are three or four ways this can happen. Pre-trial, you can make a motion to dismiss if the indictment doesn't charge a crime or the crime is unconstitutional. You can make a motion at the close of the government's case, and that will keep it from going to the jury. There'll be an acquittal. Or you can make a motion if the jury convicts for a new trial or an acquittal. And in that case, the judge overrules the jury. So it happens in several different places, but the judge can overrule the jury. In one way, it can't overrule. If the jury acquits, it can't overrule it and say, no, I think it was enough. But if it convicts, they can't overrule it. Yep.
I see. Why do you think other countries have not imitated the American jury, other democracies? I can understand why dictatorships don't want it. That's clear. Or countries that are very authoritarian. But why do other democracies like Israel or Germany or France or England, why don't they adopt our jury system? What do they know that we don't know? Or vice versa?
They know that judicial decisions made by judges tend to be perhaps more accurate, fewer mistakes. But we know what they don't know, and that is that the jury serves as an important check. Remember, most of the other countries also don't have elected judges, so they don't need the check as much. By the way, a number of these countries, particularly recently liberated former Eastern European Soviet Union countries, have introduced modified trial by juries. You know, you have a an advisory jury or a six-person jury or a mixed jury and judge. There have been a few situations like that that have been developed, or maybe getting closer to adopt the English system, which nominally has trial by jury, but realistically, most cases are decided by the judge. But we're the only country that has a full flush trial by jury, and the jury really does get to decide. And if the judge tries to put his thumb on the scale too heavily, the Court of Appeals will reverse.
Got it. Now, I'd like to talk about vaccine mandates for a minute. I know that you have a book coming out on this subject. And
You know,
the subject at hand from the Sowell book is the intellectual elites versus the common man, the wisdom or common sense of the common man. And how does that overlay with the concept of, you know, the individual being able to decide for him or herself if they want to get vaccinated? And where do you stand on this issue?
It depends on the nature of the vaccine. If a vaccine were developed which cured cancer with 100% certainty, without a single negative to it, no side effects, 100% certainty, absolutely safe, I would not mandate it because cancer is not contagious. On the other hand, if you have a disease that's highly contagious, like COVID, then it's not your decision. It's your decision to protect your life. It's not your decision to protect your neighbors or your friends or your people who you come in contact with. So it becomes a social decision. And we've accepted that for years. The polio vaccine, everybody got it. Everybody knew it was the right thing to do, the smallpox vaccine. It's that we now live in a so divided a country that everything is partisan. Everything is divided. Mm-hmm. And so even the vaccine is divided. In my book, The Case for Vaccine Mandates, I say the mandate is constitutionally permissible as a last resort if the science justifies it, with appropriate exceptions, and if it's enacted by the legislature. So I don't necessarily think Biden's mandate is constitutional because it was done by the executive. But if the legislature said, look, we have hearings, the new strains are getting worse, it's more contagious, let's assume evidence is developed that it really is dangerous, we're not sure now what the danger of the COVID is. But if all of those conditions were met, I think the Supreme Court would uphold it. They already have in 1905 in a case called Jacobson. That was a state case done legislatively, only a $5 fine and smallpox. Everything's different, but it's the only precedent. So in the book, I try to present a nuanced constitutional analysis of all the mandates, masking mandates, distancing mandates, closing of restaurants, closing of, you know, all of those things. And they're very complicated. Everyone has a different answer. And the answer isn't clear. So the book, the title of the book is a little more certain than the actual inside of the book. So you'll see a lot of nuance when you read the book than when you just read the title.
Now, a key part of that equation is some sort of evidence that the vaccine reduces the transmittability of the disease, right? Has that been established yet?
Well, the earlier variations on the vaccine, yes. With the newest variations, not so much. But from a common sense point of view, the fewer people who get infected, the less likely there will be variations, the less likely there'll be transmittal. So there's two issues. One, does it prevent the direct transmission? And the evidence of that is uncertain. If you've been vaccinated, you can still spread it to somebody else. But if you don't have it, you can't spread it. And if you are less likely to get it, if you are vaccinated, then the spread is slowed down. So almost all credible epidemiologists have advocated widespread vaccination on the theory that one way or another, it slows down the spread. But people shouldn't claim too much or too little. We have to follow the science. And the science is inconclusive at this point.
Okay. Thank you. And when is the book coming out?
What's out? It's out,
it's out now. Okay, great. Great. I'll definitely read it.
To the point, then it's easily available on Amazon. So, and it's a 2-hour read.
So I just wanted to just end this conversation, just coming back to the jury for a second. So it sounds like you're a huge believer and a fan of our jury system and an advocate for it.
Well, it's like Winston Churchill said about democracy, it may be the worst system ever developed except for all the others that have been developed over time. For America, it's the least worst system. It has all kinds of problems, but our criminal justice system has all kinds of problems, and it does produce some wrong verdicts. But most of the wrong verdicts are verdicts of acquittal where there should be convictions. And I suspect that most of us believe that better 10 guilty go free than one innocent be wrongly convicted. And so the jury system is part of that. It's not perfect. It's not flawless. It's riddled with problems, but it's better than the alternative.
On that note, I'd like to thank you for joining me on the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. Alan Dershowitz, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure and honor, and I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
So let me end this episode here. The truth is, I could talk for another few hours about the ideas and arguments presented in Intellectuals and Society. I presented only 10 points in this episode as an artificial way to convey the brilliance brought forth by Sowell in this work. I could easily have come up with 30 or 40 more critical arguments offered by Sowell in the book. He goes into great lengths on some fascinating subjects, including the role of judges in shaping society, the causes of war, the causes of crime, the role of teachers and journalists in society. And over again, he explores the incentives and constraints which lead public intellectuals to mislead the public in myriad ways for personal gain, fame, fortune, and to prove themselves on the side of the angels against the forces of evil. This book is a masterpiece, and I don't think I'm exaggerating in the least when I say that. It should be required reading for every high school and college student in the world, and one could easily spend an entire school semester studying and discussing it. Once you have read it and absorbed and reflected upon its arguments, you can never again see the world in the same ways which you did before you read it. Intellectuals and Society is the ultimate intellectual red pill.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back.
I'm Alan Wolin, and this has been episode 9 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. Thanks for listening.